You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. More than 4 months after Russia first invaded Ukraine at the end of February, the war is still grinding forward. Some of Russia's latest strikes have targeted cities in southern and central Ukraine, the latest being the southern city of Mykolaiv, where, according to local officials and reported by the New York Times, Russian missiles hit two universities, a hotel, and a mall. Here's Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in a video address posted to his website yesterday. He started the address saying he's speaking not to Ukrainians, but to the country's democratic partners. He demands Russia be officially declared a terrorist state.
Жодна інша держава світу не дозволяє собі щоденно знищувати крилатими ракетами і реактивною артилерією мирні міста і звичайне людське життя.
Translating here, no other state in the world, he said, allows itself to destroy peaceful cities and ordinary human life with cruise missiles and rocket artillery every day. We're going to be talking about the state of the war in Ukraine, how effective Western support has been, and whether it can hold out much longer. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about where things stand with the war? Do you think the U.S. and its allies have done enough to help Ukraine and to punish Russia? What more would you like to see them do, if anything? And what questions do you have about the wartime goals of Russia, Ukraine, and the situation on the ground right now? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lowell Barrington is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. He's also a research affiliate with UW-Madison's Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia. Lowell, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Dean. It's great to be back on.
Good to have you. As I mentioned in the intro, some recent Russian attacks in central and southern Ukraine. Where is the majority of fighting happening right now?
Well, we're 4.5 months into the war, and as you might remember, the initial assault that was really in a few different places but had focused on Kyiv and went very badly for Russia has led them to focus initially more on the south and southeast, and then most recently really in the far east of Ukraine, in the areas of Luhansk and Donetsk, what's known as the Donbass region. And that had been going better for them, certainly than some of the earlier parts of the conflict. But it is interesting to see these missile strikes, especially really over the last month, where they have been hitting areas that are far from the central areas of fighting right now for them, including the attack earlier this week in Vinnytsia. That's actually in kind of west central Ukraine. It was a pretty long strike away from where the fighting is mostly going on right now.
And what do you attribute that to, those attacks in more civilian areas?
Well, this isn't new. Russia has been hitting areas that have been civilian targets, at least according to the Ukraine and the West, for much of the war. But there were times when they would do that and times when they'd back off. And one theory about it not happening for a while was they were actually running low on the kinds of precision missiles they were trying to use. But in the last month or so, seem to have done that more frequently. So that's one possibility. The other is that Ukraine has had some success in the last week or two, in particular, thanks to some of the new weapons they're using from the United States and Europe in the east. And this may be something where Russia is also sort of lashing out a bit in terms of things not going quite as well in the east in the last week.
In that far eastern part of Ukraine, is there much territory changing hands right now between Russia and Ukraine?
The changes are not real swift right now. Russia had been making kind of incremental gains in a few key cities and things, for example, up to a week or so ago. Ukraine has had some success actually in the southern part of the country, and the area around Kherson, for example. They have actually pushed Russia out of a number of settlements or smaller towns and things in that area. So they've had some successes there, but it is largely been kind of a bit of a stalemate for the last week or so in the east, at least.
We're talking with Lowell Barrington right now, associate professor of political science at Marquette University, an expert on Eastern Europe and Russia, talking about the latest in the war in Ukraine. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones now. We have Nick with us in La Crosse. Hi, Nick.
Hello.
What was on your mind?
When this war started, And it was evident that the Ukrainians were going to fight and the Russians were in trouble. We sort of given them, if we weren't going to provide troops, which was off the table, we sort of provided them heavy arms right from the beginning. And I wrote a letter to the La Crosse Tribune that was published stating that the West was going to have blood on their hands. And they have a lot of blood on their hands because they never acted forcefully in the, from the beginning.
Nick, thanks for the call. Lowell, what do we know about the support that the U.S. has given Ukraine militarily up to this point and right now?
Well, Nick's point is an interesting one, and I will agree to a certain extent in that we had not focused initially in our aid packages on some of the heavy artillery and some of the newer, higher tech heavy artillery that they are now receiving. But some of that had to do with the way that the Russians were fighting. That was not a central priority in some ways for the Ukrainians. They were much better off early on using many of the things that we had supplied them, including the Javelin anti-tank weapons that they were very successful with early on, the Stinger anti-helicopter things, some of the drone things that they've been using that we've supplied them. And I think it's also important to say, we gave them a lot of the really nuts and bolts basics of artillery rounds and, you know, millions of rounds of small ammunition, tens of thousands of body armor and helmets, and, you know, things that they really needed early on as well. But one of the other challenges, the bigger and the kind of more powerful the equipment, the longer it takes to get it there and the harder it is to transport it to where Ukraine needs it in the battlefield. So some of this has been a timing issue. The new HIMARS systems, which have been really effective, they are mobile, but you also, when you get them into the country, initially some of these larger things can be a bit more visible, and there was a fear that, you know, again, Russia might be targeting these more effectively, some of these bigger heavy artillery systems. So that was slowing down things as well a bit. So I think it's fair to say we didn't give them heavy arms early on, but it would be a mistake to jump from that to the idea that we have not been providing a lot of support.
And has that support made a measurable effect on the battlefield, do you think?
Well, it's made a huge effect, again, early on in the initial attack on Kyiv, for example. The Ukrainians were really successful with attacking the lines and sort of columns of tanks and other vehicles and things that the Russians were using. The losses by Russia of tanks alone, I mean, not to mention the soldiers, which is another really just amazing number and kind of tragic thing for Russia right now. But, I mean, the estimates are that Russia's lost about 1,500 tanks so far. Ukraine has captured a lot of these and been able to use them. So one of the strange statistics, they have a whole part of their military, for example, that is essentially a bunch of mechanics that fix up these Russian tanks and send them back out for the Ukrainians to use. And one of the interesting statistics is that Ukraine actually has more tanks now than it did at the start of the army, start of the war. Sorry, this army has, you know, seized so many tanks and things that it's got more tanks than they had at the beginning. And there was a joke going around about one of the things that's been happening is that farmers have actually been capturing some of these tanks that have been damaged or abandoned. And, you know, you see these videos of Ukrainian farmers are dragging these tanks down the road with their tractors. And the joke was that Ukrainian farmers had become the fifth largest army in the world. And that's not true. But if you had the sort of took the number of tanks they'd captured, it was something like the 35th largest army in terms of tanks, you know, just that Ukrainian farmers had captured. So, again, I think they've had a lot of successes. And the part of the war we're in now has been more challenging. This is where Russia has turned toward just a real use of constant artillery bombardment, you know, again, not being very discriminating between civilians and military targets. And that has required Ukraine to try to switch to some of these more long-range and larger artillery attack systems.
What do we know about Vladimir Putin's goals at this point, how they may have changed, and what he could see as an acceptable outcome?
Well, boy, that's the tough question. I mean, I can say certainly his approach changed in the sense that early on they really thought they could get the capital, Kyiv, in relatively short order. I think there's a pretty good understanding that the thought on the Russian side was it might be a week or 2 weeks and they would have control of Kyiv, and that clearly did not happen. So at that point, there seemed to be two ways that Putin's focus changed. One was to make sure they got control of as much of the south, and in particular the Black Sea coast, as possible. And then the other thing was to now then move the fighting back into the Far East, which had been an area of fighting, obviously ongoing since 2014 on and off. This is not a brand new war there. But Russia has really focused its attention on the East and again, has succeeded, for example, in largely getting full control of the entire region of Luhansk right now through some of its successes in the last few weeks.
We're talking with Lowell Barrington, associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University, affiliate with UW-Madison Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia. We're talking about the latest in the war on Ukraine, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you continued to follow updates out of Ukraine? Have you had difficulty following the ongoing war as it's faded a bit in the news? What questions do you have about U.S. and Western support? Is it something you'd like to see continue and the U.S. continue to stand behind financially, militarily? Where do you think the war is going? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter. We continue our talk with Marquette University's Lowell Barrington. We're looking at the effectiveness and endurance of Western support for Ukraine in its war against the Russian invasion. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. If you have thoughts about how the war is going, questions about what it will take to reach a conclusion, call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Lowell, just in the last week, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson resigned, and he was an early and a very staunch advocate for backing Ukraine militarily, financially. What impact do you think his resignation could have on support from the West?
That's a really important question. I think the real short answer is, so far it looks like the support from the UK is going to continue, even as a replacement Prime Minister comes into position in the UK. But I don't want to downplay his role. He and President Biden actually both should receive much more credit, I think, than they both have in really leading this very united Western stance against Russia in this conflict, and you know, getting the UK and Germany and France together on the same page on things is not always easy. And Johnson, you're right, was very forceful. He traveled to Kyiv multiple times, and even to the point where there are towns in Ukraine that have been discussing changing street names to name them for Boris Johnson. I mean, this is something where in Ukraine he's an incredibly popular figure because of how, again, as you said, early and strong his support for Ukraine was. But again, I think some of the leading figures that are looking to be kind of potential contenders, at least to take over for Johnson, include Liz Truss, who's the foreign secretary, and Ben Wallace, who's the defense secretary. And both of them have been, you know, again, very vocal and very strong in their support of Ukraine against Russia. So I think in the grand scheme of things, it won't change a lot. But Ukraine and President Zelensky in particular were certainly not happy to see Boris Johnson's resignation announcement.
We'll go next to the phones. We have Glenn with us on I-94 right now. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I only wanted to comment, frankly, on the query that you put out to the listeners as to how we feel regarding the U.S. support for the war, quote unquote, in Ukraine. And I'm 100% behind not only the financial, but the weaponry that they need now at this juncture in the war, because it's, you know, it's changed. It's changed so much from when it was in Kyiv to where it is now. And that's what they really need, the HIMARS systems and the weaponry that actually goes along with that. Because it's not just one piece of equipment, it's a multiple set, you know. It's something that I was just listening to the section on Boris Johnson as well. I think if Wallace, the UK defense secretary, takes that job, I don't think the position will be a lot worse. And I understand Zelensky's disappointment in Johnson's resignation. I really do. But it isn't always from the top. It's got to be a unified front.
Got it. Glenn, thank you so much for the call. Lowell, looking at U.S. military support, this war could still go on for a while. Do we have a sense of how long U.S. support could last, could be there?
So far, the commitment from the United States has been strong. It continues to be strong, and I don't expect that to waver. I think it's one of the things that the Biden administration can point to as some real successes of getting Ukraine these weapons that they've been able to use. And certainly the Ukrainian military has outperformed what a lot of people were expecting at the beginning of the war. And I think the support from the United States and Europe is a part of that. Glenn's comment, by the way, about the HIMARS system is interesting. This is a really important new, relatively new weapon system, at least for Ukraine, to have. The acronym is for High Mobility Artillery Rocket Systems. So these are precision and longer range. They use GPS to guide these rockets that are going in. And Ukraine's used them quite effectively. The point, though, that they still don't have a lot of these is correct, at least in terms of what they want. They've got around 12 systems, I believe, that at least are in the process of being delivered. A few of them they've been using already now. But to actually have equal footing with Russia to be able to just do whatever they wanted to against the Russians, you might need as many as 60 to 100 of those systems in place, and you know, we're not on pace to get them those. So, you know, it's certainly always more could be done, but again, I think we want to keep in mind the commitments so far from the United States of $7 billion in support, since February alone.
Thanks for that call, Glenn. Let's go next to Mary Kay in Kenosha. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi, I would like to see more diplomacy, like some of our news in Russia. Also, peace talks with Putin from NATO. And we have to keep helping Ukraine, whether with Doctors Without Borders and militarily. And to show Putin that if he opens up his border for trade and education and things, it's going to be way better than what he's doing to these people.
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. Lowell, what do you think about the prospect for more peace talks?
Well, I am always a supporter of diplomacy over fighting if it can work. There have been some talks, and there are actually some pretty interesting and important talks that started and then fell apart a bit. But on just something that sounds kind of basic, but in Russia and Ukraine trying to work together to get the grain in Ukraine out to the world. You know, we're facing this grain shortage and food crisis in parts of the world, partly because of this war. And Ukraine right now has around 22 million metric tons of grain that is stuck in silos and storage facilities because it can't get it out through the ports and things that it used to be able to use. So even something like that, if there can be an agreement between Ukraine and Russia, right, that those kinds of agreements can sometimes start the ball rolling toward bigger agreements. But getting to a negotiated settlement at the end of the war is really hard at this point. The centrality of identity in this war, this has been as much about identity as it has been about economics and even territory. And so, you know, Putin really feels like he needs a big victory at this point. And I think Zelensky can't be seen as sort of surrendering territory. So we're still at a place where finding that solution is hard through diplomacy. I think there is a territorial solution down the road that they may get to at some point. But I think, unfortunately, we are quite a ways from that. And we're looking at a minimum of months more of this conflict.
We heard from Tim in St. Germain, who couldn't stay on the line, but asked if Lowell, you think this could end in a division of territory like North Korea and South Korea. We, of course, had the invasion of Crimea in 2014. Is it possible that something like that could, there could be a division of territory that Tim is thinking about?
I mean, we've de facto had that a bit since 2014 in the sense of the areas in the far eastern parts of Ukraine that what were called the separatists, but with a lot of Russian help, had been controlling that territory de facto. And Crimea has essentially been incorporated into Russia now as a territorial unit. I think what's more likely is, and it would be hard for Ukraine to accept this, but I mean, that there will in fact be some sort of territorial concession in the east that at a minimum would include something like Luhansk and Donetsk entirely, maybe with a special status where they're not part of Russia. I think Russia will act to try to actually make them part of Russian territory. What's interesting about that, though, is for Ukraine long term, while it's devastating in terms of Ukrainian identity and it will be seen as something that's really politically very difficult for Zelensky to do, they will be more united and more European-looking and more Western-looking if Russia grabs those regions than if Russia were to leave them in Ukraine. And so I think that one of the interesting things to look at is if we think real long term, as hard as it will be for Ukraine to want to accept this, that Ukraine itself, the population and the where the territory is, where there's kind of the most and least pro-Russian support, the loss of Donetsk and Luhansk would actually make Ukraine more united and more pro-Western and potentially even accelerate things, you know, like EU and NATO membership.
And Lowell, in our last minute, what is the factor that you have your eye on in the coming months?
I think whether the U.S. can and Europe can continue to get Ukraine more and more of these large weapon systems that can do a lot more damage, the damage we've started to see in the last few weeks. Ukraine has hit a number of storage facilities and command centers with some of these new weapons, still in Ukraine, but doing a lot of damage to the Russian effort and slowing them down. And so I think that's one thing to keep an eye on. The other thing, that people have talked about a bit, but is Putin's role in all this in terms of what, you know, maybe he does decide at some point that he's got enough of a victory. Maybe he does start pushing for more talks and things like that. I don't see that immediate. He hasn't indicated that as a likely thing in the near term. But at some point, he may decide that as his military still becomes, you know, more and more fatigued, even with this new focus on the East, that it would be time for talks. So we can perhaps at least hope that could happen.
Lowell, thanks as always for joining us.
And thank you.
Lowell Barrington is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. He was with us to talk about the latest in the war on Ukraine. Coming up Monday on Central Time, the first woman to hike all 11 National Scenic Trails just finished up her goal in Wisconsin. We'll talk with her about her time on the Ice Age Trail and what's next. Plus, a new study on ice cover going down in the Great Lakes over the last several years. We'll look at the data and why it matters. That's Monday on Central Time. Coming up after the news, what does it take to change someone's mind? We'll talk to a science journalist about his new book that says if you're arguing facts and logic, you might be going about it the wrong way. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about summertime sandwiches for this week's edition of Food Friday. First, we all have people in our lives we disagree with. Maybe you have a close friend who has a different opinion on gun rights, or a family member who disagrees with you on pandemic safety measures. Talking about those disagreements can be really hard. And a lot of times, those conversations turn into arguments, and both parties end up more dug into their beliefs. Our next guest says that's because we're trying to go about changing someone's mind all wrong. He says it is possible to persuade someone, but facts and logic won't get us very far. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. How do you handle conversations when you disagree with someone? Do you try to argue your point with facts? Has your own mind ever been changed on an issue? If so, how did that change happen? We want to hear from you. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David McRaney is a science journalist and the host of the You Are Not So Smart podcast. He's written multiple books, including his latest, How Minds Change, The Surprising Science of Belief, Opinion, and Persuasion. David, thanks for being here.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this book was a bit of a personal journey for you. You admit at the start that you were someone who didn't always think it was possible to change a lot of minds. What started changing for you and getting you interested in persuasion?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I've run my podcast for like more than a decade now, and I've written about this for a long time. It's been my beat for a while to talk about biases, fallacies, heuristics, and motivated reasoning, judgment, decision-making, all of the psychology and social science, neuroscience that goes into that. And motivated reasoning is, there's a sort of cynicism that can go along with studying that for too long, I think. And I had become very pessimistic about it. The inciting moment for me, those two things combined. I was doing a lecture, and someone asked me after the lecture, they said, I have a family member who is falling into a conspiracy theory. What can I do about it? And I told them, nothing. You can't do anything about it. And I didn't even believe it as it came out of my mouth. I didn't like the tone. I didn't like what I was suggesting. And also realized I didn't know enough about the prescriptive side of everything. I was all description, no prescription. So I wanted to dig into that more and give a better answer going forward. And I wish I could get a time machine and go back. But the other thing that happened was, while I was saying that, also the norms around same-sex marriage, the attitudes in the United States were changing very rapidly. And I looked at the polling, and 60% of the country just a few years earlier had been opposed, and now 60% was in favor of same-sex marriage. And I imagined what would happen if you took all of those people in the majority and sent them back 10 years and they had them meet themselves. They would argue, they would debate, they'd get mad at each other. They refuse to change their minds in the presence of their own selves. And I just wondered, what's that all about? Not only what's going on in the brain when we disagree, but what happened in the interim so that a person after all of that could look back and say, oh yeah, of course I was wrong about that. That was available to them at any time, but something happened to lock it into place. That's what led me down this whole path. And yeah, I really did change my mind. There's a lot of comeuppance in this book about reaching out to people who resist and using better methods and so on.
And something that you found might at first be discouraging to us, and that's that facts, logic, not gonna always work. What are we getting wrong when we try to use those facts and logic?
Yeah, I think about this a lot. You know, there's a lot of frustration, especially right now, because we spend so much time arguing on the internet. And as I say in the book, I think that's good. I think that's a good thing we're all arguing. But the way in which we argue in a lot of our contexts is really poorly done. And we have this intuition about how to reach out to other people. I feel like that frustration should be directed at ourselves more than the other party. It's like trying to reach the moon with a ladder. And then when you fail, saying, well, the moon's unreachable. It's the technique that you're using. It's the approach that you're using. One of the things that makes this not work is that we all start with a motivation, and we go from that motivation, that emotion, that identity, that desire, that drive. We look at all the information available to us, and we cherry pick what seems to justify the feeling that we have. And then that becomes our collection of reasons for why we think, feel, and believe something. And when we meet someone who sees things differently, feels differently, we often take something out of that collection and say, this is why I think this, but that's not why you think it. That's a justification that you arrived at later. The reason why you think and feel this may be something that you aren't even really aware of. That's also happening on the other side. They've done the same thing and they have their collection. And if you just battle it out at the level of those conclusions, at those reasons, those justifications and rationalizations, you never get at why do you feel this way? What causes you to choose that and not something else? Why are you selectively skeptical? So I advocate for it throughout the book that you, instead of facing off against people in that way, get out of the debate frame, the I have to win, you have to lose, someone's right, someone's wrong, and instead try to get shoulder to shoulder, where the goal is invite the other person to participate in a team up exercise to investigate a mystery together, which is, why do you think we might disagree about this? And there's a lot more, everything that I talk about in the book, all the different persuasion techniques, all the people that I've met, even the people that have left conspiratorial communities and cults and pseudo cults, this is the technique. This is the conversational approach that delivers the results. Because we all can change our minds, and we all do update our assumptions and entertain other points of view when it's presented in a certain way, when it avoids this reactance, as they call it in psychology. And that's the better path. It's not a book about how to win friends and influence people. It's a very different approach from that sort of manipulation, coercion way of doing things. It's a very different way of approaching another mind that sees things differently.
We're talking with David McRaney right now, a science journalist, host of the You Are Not So Smart podcast, and author of the new book, How Minds Change, The Surprising Science of Belief, Opinion, and Persuasion. We're talking about how minds do change and how you can go about it in your own life. And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. When you have people you disagree with, how do you talk with them? Have you found a good way to talk across those divides? Has your own mind ever been changed on an issue? We'd love to hear about it. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David, one group you spent some time with were the Deep Canvassers in California. This is really interesting work they've been doing for a number of years now. Can you talk about what deep canvassing is, how it works?
Sure. The one of the most fascinating things, I had no idea this was going to happen. It was very surprising. I wanted to spend time with people who professionally change people's minds, and I spent time with deep canvassing and motivational interviewing and street epistemology and all sorts of other groups. All these groups had never met each other. Many of them were aware of psychological literature that would help explain what they did worked, yet they'd all independently come up with sort of the same approach. And if they had steps in their process, the steps were in the same order. And the first group that I met, it was from the leadership lab at the LGBT Center of Los Angeles. They're sort of the political action wing of that group. And they were trying to understand how Prop 8 had unfolded in California when California voted against same-sex marriage in a state where that just seemed very improbable. And they went door to door to try to figure out what was going on. And they simply asked people at their front doors, why did you vote against this issue? And they were astonished to find that first of all, people were very willing to have that conversation, but also sometimes in talking about the issue, the person at their front door would see it differently by the end of the conversation. So they started recording, and after about 17,000 conversations recorded on video, they A/B tested all of this and threw away what didn't work, kept what did, and they arrived at this really powerful technique they call deep canvassing, which they've now expanded to many different issues, and it's all over the country now. It's not just in California. And it works in a very particular way. I can go through the steps if you'd like, but that's what happened when I went there and canvassed with them, trained in it, went door to door with them, and was just amazed. I went into their archives and watched a lot of the videos and was just astonished to watch people enter the conversation feeling one way and leaving the conversation feeling another. And it's a listening technique more than anything. It's a way to hold space and allow another person to introspect in a very particular way so that they can, in a way, discover their actual belief or their opinion on the matter in a way that isn't received wisdom anymore, isn't signaling in any way, is not an attempt to maintain a reputation or an identity. It's strangely very freeing for the person on the other side.
Yeah, that sounds like it's a really potentially uncomfortable situation. You show up at someone's door and say, hey, let's talk about controversial topic X, Y, or Z. What kind of listening techniques or tools did the canvassers use to sort of get people out of the normal black and white thinking and start getting them to approach it in a different way?
Okay, this is very powerful. And although there are about 9 steps in this, you really only need to come away from this with 2. So anybody listening, these first 2 you can apply today. But the first, you know, they did in their technique, they would knock on a person's door and say hello, and they would build rapport very quickly right off the bat. The idea here is to avoid something in psychology I mentioned earlier called reactance. We all have a really strong motivation to push away any stimulus that threatens our autonomy. And if someone's telling you how to think or how you should think or suggesting you should be ashamed for how you currently think, we will very quickly push back. And then often what happens is then you push back a little harder, and then you enter into a feedback loop that ends with one of these angry, you know, let's agree to disagree kind of things, which I hate that expression, by the way, because obviously we agree to disagree. That's how we started the conversation. The way you get out of this is to assure the other person you're not out to shame them in any way. Ask for their consent to explore their reasoning and be very transparent about what you're up to. And more than anything, express you are curious about why they feel the way they feel, how they feel about the issue at hand. Most people, when it's framed that way, are very eager to then share their view on the issue. And then they take whatever the issue is in particular, and this is the really incredible part of this, is ask, how do you feel on this issue on a scale from 0 to 10? If it's a fact-based issue, you can ask, what's your level of certainty? How certain are you? How confident are you that this is true? But if it's an attitude-based issue,
a political issue, oftentimes a wedge issue, you can say, well, like if it's gun control, for example, like a 10 would be all guns in the country need to be destroyed, and if you're found with one, it's a death penalty. And zero would be you should get a free gun in the mail every week. Where are you on that scale? And oftentimes this is all it takes to have the conversation that I'm talking about. You can imagine just if I ask you the last movie that you watched, what would you give it on a scale? If you ask you how did you like it, you'll say yes or no. But if I ask you where would you put yourself on the scale, you say maybe a 7. Then I ask, why a 7? You can feel that feeling that most people have. We begin to think in a very different way. On one of these issues, they ask that, and then if the person is a 7 on the issue, they can ask, why do you feel that way? But then they can also say, why not a 6, why not a 5, or why not an 8, why not a 10? And when this all comes from motivational interviewing, though they weren't aware that's where it comes from, a therapeutic technique where if a person wants to move away from a particular side of that spectrum, you can ask them, why aren't they closer to that side? And oftentimes people will produce their own counter arguments they may never have articulated before. And those counter arguments will be something that adds weight to feeling differently about it. In deep canvassing, the next thing they usually do is they share a story about someone who's affected by the issue. Often they show a video. Then they ask for that number a second time. And if it's moved, they ask, well, why did it move? And what they're doing constantly here is holding space, not non-judgmentally, compassionately listening to the other person and giving that person a chance to say, why do I feel this way? Why did I move? Why does that number feel right to me? And always repeat it back in their own words, use that a person's definitions if they have them, and summarize and repeat in such a way that they feel like they're really being heard and they're really starting to get a chance to truly articulate how they feel. And then you can go further to say, is there a time in your life before you felt that way? Are there examples from your life where you have actually been close to this issue? If not, you'll start to see that it's very received wisdom. If so, oftentimes those stories come into conflict with the attitude that you're portraying. And you just listen in this way. You continuously hold that space. And then at the end, you can share your own story. At the end, you can show where your perspective is at. But you say it in such a way, you say, well, you know, it's fascinating. I find you a very intelligent and reasonable person. It's odd that I see it differently than you. I wonder why we see it so differently. You know, from my perspective, this, this, and this. And at no point in any of that is an argument taking place. At no point are you trying to copy and paste anything out of your head into their head. And they have an incredible success rate with this approach for shifting people around on many different wedge issues.
We're talking with science journalist David McRaney about his new book, How Minds Change. Taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Have you found a good way to talk across divides? Has your own mind been changed on an issue? Why was that? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with science journalist David McRaney, here today to talk about his book, How Minds Change, The Surprising Science of Belief, Opinion, and Persuasion. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones. We have Tom in Burlington. Hi, Tom.
Let me make a little quick comment here. I wrote a musical with Warren Casey, the man who wrote Grease. And when you write a musical, you ask the audience, well, how did you like this show or what did you think about this show? And they always tell you, they tell you what they think you want to hear. And then what he would say, well, how can I make it better? And once you ask them how to make it better, then they say, well, the costume was wrong and the music was a little bit off and this was a little bit there and this was a little bit there. And you finally get to what they really thought about the, your question in the first place. But that's one way of, you know, getting the truth out of people. But the next question I wanted to ask is, if you want to change somebody's mind, do you use logic, go straight at them with logic, or do you skirt around the logic and go in a different direction to kind of change it? It's really, it seems like you can't change people's minds.
Got it, Tom. Thanks for the call. David, Tom, thinking like many people, that logic should be the place we start. As you've been saying, understanding and getting at experiences and motivations seem to be the more productive way, at least to start understanding each other.
Yeah, you can't go in with logic and facts unless you're in one of these environments where that's sort of the rules of the game, like a good faith environment where, you know, hey, we're going to get behind lecterns, we're going to be in front of an audience, or We are in a scientific circle where we go with hypothesis testing and null hypothesis and evidence, and we're going to go with theories and models, and I'm going to vet you, you're going to vet me. There are plenty of places where that's the right approach. There are philosophical domains where we would go with propositions and use logic almost like a mathematical language. It's a great tool. It's an amazing thing. It's a great invention of human talent. But most of the time when we're having conversations with people, especially face-to-face, we're going to fall back on much more primates, ultra-social primate evolutionary domains of how people parse language and understand things. And it's, we're going to really have to deal with justifications. You know, like you can think of it like this. Like when a person is falling in love with somebody, all the things that they say, why am I falling? Why do I like this person? It'll be like the way they talk, the way they walk, the way they cut their food, the music they listen to, the TV shows they like. Then when they're breaking up with that person, they'll say, why are you breaking up with them? Well, because of the way they talk, the way they walk, the way they cut their food, the dumb music they listen to, the dumb TV shows. The reasons remain the same. The facts remain the same, but the motivation has changed, and the thing we say is the reason for or against can be the exact same reason. And that's also true in an argument. That's why in psychology, reasoning should not be confused with reason, the philosophical concept of like intellect and rationality. In psychology, reasoning is simply coming up with reasons for what you think, feel, and believe. We're very good at that. You have to get a step behind that process if you want to get at why a person actually is choosing those reasons out of all the other things they could be saying. And that's the place where you're trying to move the conversation and the techniques that I'm talking about in the book. And I would also note that what your example of, if you ask people why they didn't like it, the play, like you're doing sort of the inverse of what you should do in a motivational interviewing environment, because you're asking them to give you reasons for why they don't like it, and they will. And then they'll walk away with all that articulation. And it's one of those things where if they were a 7 in the movie, you would ask, why not a 4? Why not a 3? And now they'll produce arguments in the other direction. Well, I did like this. I did like that. I did like this. And they'll walk away from the conversation having articulated reasons for liking the thing instead of against it.
David, we just have a couple of minutes left, but before we run out of time, I'd like to touch on the story of Charlie that you mentioned in the book. He was a 9/11 conspiracy theorist, very deep, very high profile in that world. Came out of it, though, renounced the conspiracy theories. What changed his mind?
Yeah, I explore a couple of people like that in the book. I go to Westboro Baptist Church. I spent time with the Moonies and anti-vaxxers, flat earthers, and Charlie, who is a 9/11 truther, he was. He went on a conspiracy road trip television show, actually, with a group of other people who shared his conspiratorial beliefs, but he was the only one who changed his mind. The others actually walked away from getting all this evidence. They went to the crash sites. They flew airplanes. They did all sorts of things that you would love to do with a person who is deep into conspiracy theory, to show them these really raw facts. And they went away feeling even more strongly about it, whereas he went the other way. He changed his mind. I was very curious about this, and after spending time with people who left conspiratorial groups and cults and pseudo-cults, pretty much the same thing usually happens. There's a onboarding process where people usually have some sort of anxiety or identity issue, or they have some sort of need for validation, or a prejudice that the conspiratorial community that they fall into helps them take those things and solves those drives. It meets their needs in a certain way. And then after that, it's just the community that they stick around for. They really want to stay in that group of people and stay in that group hug. The way out, though, the offboarding process, the off-ramp, for everyone I spoke to and that I met, typically someone outside of that group was non-judgmentally offered to listen to them and see their point of view and revealed to them that there were other groups outside of the group that they were in that they could affirm their values within. And it helps a person see that I do have these core values that are separate from the group, and they could be met in a different way in a different group. And once a person has that sort of social safety net, they have a foot in more than one social world, then all of the inconsistencies and the things that frustrate them and the things about the group that they're in that normally that they would forgive start to become a little bit more unforgivable. In Charlie's case, he was hugging people who had lost family members. And
David, I'm so sorry. We were just about out of time. Thanks to our guest, David McRaney, author of the new book, How Minds Change. More coming up on Central Time. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.